every single time I went to the garage, my wife would walk in the room. She's like, you're embarrassing. And we'd just walk out every single time.
Sexy vampires were a thing back then.
Do this. We want it. Or at least I want it.
But it's covered in powder so you can see it.
That's some terrible dialogue.
Not as fast as Phineas Fogg. Got around the world in 80 days.
Hello and welcome to Movie.
Hello and welcome to Movie Smash, the show where we dive headfirst into comic book movies outside of the MCU. If you're new to the show, thanks for joining us. If you've been here before, you know the drill. Each episode, we're going to smash a movie whose source materials from a graphic novel or a comic. Is it worth revisiting? Should it be forgotten? Let's find out. This is Movie Smash. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Roberts. I'm the founder of Off Panel Creations. With me today, I have a gentleman who is also in public domain, Jeremy Parmentier.
Hey, I'm Jeremy Parmentier, also of the Retrovaniacs podcast, and an extremely ordinary gentleman.
Also with us today is Shane Kanto from Wasteland Watchlist. Thanks for joining us today, Shane.
Thank you guys so much for having me. Yeah, I spend a lot of time talking about a bunch of random movies. It's fun to, you know, talk about one that has been close to me for 23 years since I saw this in the theater, so.
Our movie this evening is 2003's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, starring Sean Connery, Stuart Townsend, and Peter Wilson, directed by Stephen Norrington.
Welcome to the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
I'm waiting to be impressed.
The greatest adventurer who ever lived has been recruited to find a madman.
He's called the Phantom. To stop him, you must lead a team like nothing the world has seen.
Thanks.
Eyes open, boy. Can't protect you all the time.
Dr. Jekyll, at your service.
Cheers.
Extraordinary gentleman indeed.
And women.
Our transportation has arrived.
You have 4 days.
And the game is on.
So, Shane, you picked this classic movie for us.
So, when I saw this back in 2003, this is one of my favorite movies. Like, the second that I watched it, I absolutely loved it. And I've had some up and down feelings about it over the years, and I thought it would be a fun way to go back and check out this film and, like, did the effects age any better than the last time I watched this movie? Or is there still some kind of merit to it? And so I thought it'd be a fun excuse, you know, coming onto your show and picking this film to chat about.
All right, well, thank you for doing that one, because we've got something to talk about today. Mm-hmm. Were either of you guys familiar with the comic before the first time you saw this movie?
For me, I did not read any of the comics until the past year, so I had 22 years of watching this movie before I even touched any of the comics.
Yeah, I knew it was a comic. I hadn't read it at the time. Again, it's 2003, so I was kind of fresh out of working out of a comic store, so the friends I was going to see these kind of movies with were like, oh yeah, this is a comic, you know, so I'd go see it, despite that I had never read the comic. So I was pretty sure I saw this before. It's going to turn out I had not. I don't know what I thought this movie was. Watching this movie, I was like, I don't remember any of this. The only thing I remembered at all was that Sean Connery was in it and Mr. Hyde. But even that, like, that wasn't what I remembered. So I'm 99% sure. I don't know what movie I thought we were watching in 2003 that I then saw the preview for this. And I'm sure I was out drinking. It was 2003. So I'm sure I blended it all together. It was probably during some other completely separate movie. So this will be officially my first time watching it, because up till today, I could have told you what I thought the movie was about. None of it is what happened in this movie.
I was about to ask you, how many beers were you into that evening?
Well, 2003 was, honestly, who knows? There's a reason I don't remember too much about a 10-year window in there. But
we don't like to talk about those years.
No.
So me, I was not familiar. I had no idea this was a comic when I first saw this movie. I eventually learned it was a comic. And actually, my sister's collection, I found a copy of issue number one for this. So I've only ever read that issue to sort of give you an idea of how little I know about this world. Jeremy, you've alluded to this, so this was your first time seeing it.
Up until this morning, I could have told you I saw it when it was out in the theaters. No. Or, and this is very possible, there were a handful of movies that I went to that I immediately fell asleep during because we would party before the movie and then go to movies. So there's a chance I did see this movie theoretically, but I don't think that's the case because there's so much going on in this that I would have remembered. I clearly didn't see this movie before. So I'm going to say I'm 99% sure this is my first viewing of this movie.
A little pregame could have hurt you for this. Shane, when was the first time you saw it?
I saw this one in theaters. back in 2003, and being 12 years old and having this on, this was like one of my first DVDs. I probably watched this an insane amount of times when I was a young teenager. As an adult, I've probably watched it two or three times, including this rewatch. It had been a while since I had watched it, though.
Yeah, I don't know the first time I've seen this movie. I don't think I saw it in theaters, especially around that early 2000s for me. And Shane, thank you, by the way, for making me feel very old.
You're welcome.
Because I was well out of college by this point. I have seen it, obviously. I bought a copy so we can watch it because it was on Tubi, and then it went off Tubi when I needed to rewatch it for our taping today. And luckily, it was only $5 in the used DVD bin. But I've seen it. I've seen it several times. I don't know when I've seen it. It's one of those movies where you've seen it enough times, it's sort of stuck in your memory. It's sort of, it just exists in your world. But I could not recollect when I saw it. I don't know if I saw it in the theaters. I don't know if I saw it on DVD or on like TBS in the background. I have no idea when I saw this thing. But Jeremy, before we actually jump in the movie, do you have even like a little bit of the comic book history for us?
I will try. I'm no Fergal, but I'll do my best. This was originally kind of a series, like a 6-issue series that has had series since, a handful of series, written by Alan Moore, who's, you know, we did Watchmen, Alan Moore's Watchmen. And, you know, he's kind of notoriously not into the idea of his books becoming movies. It's not the only one that happened, but I don't remember him being as upset about this beforehand as he was about Watchmen beforehand. That said, to the comic itself, this movie is going to be loosely based on the concept of the comic, which is really kind of like the, not necessarily villains, but this late 19th century collection of kind of misfits that are brought together to do a mission, kind of including Dr. Jekyll, Captain Nemo, Alan Quartermain, and the Invisible Man, are kind of the original four. They add other characters later, and some of those are in this movie. Some people in this movie weren't in any of the comics. You know, it's kind of that make a collection of oddballs to become this kind of superhero group to stop some kind of global threat. So I don't know how closely this is because I have not read these. I don't know how close this is to the plot of the movie. My understanding is not very, but we'll find out.
Not at all. Having read the omnibus of like the original 6-issue run, I'm like, the plot has like nothing to do with this movie.
Yeah, it's. I think we've got one of those wanted situations where they read the first comic and that was about it. If this is your first time joining us, just a quick heads up. We're going to be discussing certain elements of this movie that might be considered spoilers. But it's filled with a lot of classical character you probably have already heard of and read those books about, so consider yourself warned. So, Shane, do you want to walk us through the plot of this movie before we get started?
Sure. So, a mysterious phantom puts the world on the brink of a world war, which was not heard of at the turn of the 20th century, and only a group of the most random literary characters that you could throw together can save it. And that's basically the movie.
Yep.
And put in a fun, dramatic way possible. So,
and I love the fact that they call it a world war when, you know, that term was actually used until after the war, and it was called the Great War at the time. Mm-hmm. But I guess this is an alternate history because I guess Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde did not exist in our real world, as far as I know.
As far as we know.
So why don't we jump into the characters? Jeremy, you kind of listed a few of them. Our main character is Alan Quartermain, played by Sean Connery. How do you feel about him playing a sub-African hunter sent there by the British Empire?
So I'm, again, not reading the source material. I can't tell you if he did a good or bad version of this character. I don't know what he's from. I don't know if he's like if Alan Quartermain, some, you got 1,000 books that I've never read. It's very possible. I've read 7 books and they all have dragons in them. So unless he's in those, I don't know. I would say, though, I mean, you can tell that this was the focus of like, oh, we want to have this movie, we don't have Sean Connery. Or once they got Sean Connery, it's like, well, we're clearly going to focus on Sean Connery. So he's fine, but he's Indiana Jones-ish. He's got that kind of same style to him, but he's definitely older. I like, and we'll talk about it a little bit, but some of the action scenes, you can see like they have him wind up and then they see someone else punching it because there's no way he's going to punch somebody. He was, what, 70-something at this time? Like, this was his last movie that he was in before he retired and then ultimately, you know, passed a few years ago. If you compare it to Indiana Jones, if you don't know what the source material is, I think that's kind of what you're close to, this kind of big game hunter that also has, you know, James Bondy sort of levels of skill.
Yeah, Alan Quartermain is from a book called King Solomon's Mines. You may have heard of King Solomon's Mines. It was written back in 1880-something, I think. But to be very frank with you, I only know that because I read it before he came on the show. I knew he was from something, but I couldn't quite place it.
Yeah, I've read King Solomon's Mine. honestly, one of the reasons why I love this movie so much when I first saw it is I've been an avid reader my whole entire life. So, like, this was like, wow, this is something I would have come up with in my head. And, you know, I put the connection together, like, years later. I didn't know going in that, like, he was specifically from King Solomon's Mine. I appreciate it. Like, Sean Connery's been one of my favorite actors from when I was a kid. I'm a big James Bond fan. I love The Untouchables. And I feel like this could have been an easy, like, phone-it-in kind of performance, but I feel like he's trying.
Yeah.
And he has, like, a gravitas and weight. But yeah, he's an aging huntsman, so, like, anytime there's any kind of physicality, you know they're editing around stunt doubles and stuff like that. But luckily, most of what he does is shoot people. So at least he can hold a gun and look steely and intimidating. And I do appreciate that. And obviously, they try to add that depth with, like, the regret of his son dying. I don't love everything they did with that storyline and how they try to compensate it, but I do like him as, like, the anchoring piece to this, and despite some of his really forced dialogue trying to make other literary references, I'm like, he tried. He tried his best.
Well, I do like the aging bit. There's a scene where the villain is running away from the hotel, and he actually has to take his glasses out and put his glasses on to shoot the guy from 500 yards away or whatever it is, and he's like, says, like, it sucks getting old. Why don't we change gears to another character then? So there's like, it's full of literary references. The next one up I've got on my list is Dorian Gray. Were you guys familiar with who that character was before seeing this movie?
Loosely. That was one that I don't know if it was from high school or when, but I knew it. I knew enough to know, like, okay, that is clearly from a book. I know a little bit about this character. Not enough to tell you, again, much about it other than I knew that it was a literary reference. And then the other characters in here, I knew. Some of them were very clearly literary references, or at least people that you would have heard of somewhere else than here. The only one I didn't know was Quarterman. So,
yeah, I was a, like I mentioned, a big avid reader. I don't think I read The Portrait of Dorian Gray or Picture of Dorian Gray before watching this, but, like, I knew the story, so I kind of knew, like, what that character was supposed to be about. He's one of my least favorite parts of this movie, and I feel bad because it's definitely the casting.
Yeah.
They were really trying to make Stuart Townsend happen in the early 2000s, and, you know, he was Aragorn, and then got fired from Lord of the Rings because it just was not working. And he was in Queen of the Damned, that Lestat adaptation, and this. I just don't have, like, any kind of vibes of charisma coming off of this performance. And as we find out later in the film, he's a pretty pivotal piece to this whole entire thing going on. And he's supposed to be, like, have this previous romantic relationship with Mina Harker. I'm like, I just, especially rewatching this, didn't buy, like, any of that connection along the way. And basically, he's just an excuse because he's immortal and you have, like, the cool effects of, like, bullet holes just, like, disappearing off of him. And, you know, he could swing a sword and kill people and not have to worry about dying. So, like, and then you get that, like, big moment of, like, his picture being revealed and them showing off special effects of him, like, aging, disintegrating, Last Crusade style.
Yeah, he's not likable. And I know he's probably not supposed to necessarily be, but I think that hurts the character because you're kind of supposed to be surprised later when you find out that he's not really supposed to be likable. And instead they have to say things like, oh yeah, you know, we used to have this relationship, or I think Quarterman at some point says, like, oh, we met years ago, but I was a student and he was, and that's how you find out he's, like, immortal. So they try to, like, add to it, but I don't know if it's a matter of trying to cram too much into a movie that I think on a printed format, when you're waiting a month for the next book, you kind of have time to mull over it and you can learn a little more about a character maybe. But it does seem here like he's, of the characters in here, he's the least, oh, I won't want to say the least. Invisible Man's up there too. Pretty like, you don't know much about him and he's not very likable. So I don't think it helps that character.
Yeah, I had forgotten that he had gotten fired, or at least was not taken for being Lord of the Rings, because Sean Connery actually was supposed to be in Lord of the Rings, and he, as he put it, I don't understand this script, so he chose not to go with it, and then he was given The Matrix and said, I don't understand it, and passed on that one, and then he was given this script, said, I don't understand it, but I guess I'm never going to understand scripts again, and chose this one, and then never did movies again because he's had such a bad experience with it. It's kind of weird when you think about it. This movie actually forced Sean Connery to retire.
He rage quit Hollywood. After this movie, he was so done. And I think the amount of money he would have made from his deal for Lord of the Rings would have been, like, astronomical. he could have bought like another castle in the Mediterranean. And it's obviously like that kind of regret made him choose this picture, and still one of the best parts, at least to me, in this film. But like this, we'll get to it more, but like there's something about this that doesn't fully click, and obviously didn't fully click with audiences either.
You mentioned Invisible Man, Jeremy. In the movie, he's actually never called the Invisible Man.
Right.
He's just Rodney, was it Rodney Skinner, I think his name was? Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because they didn't have the rights to the name Invisible Man. Everything else was in public domain, but it wasn't quite there yet for Invisible Man. So they had to work around it.
But it was obvious. One, he's invisible. So you don't have to do much else than say he's Invisible Man. But I liked the effects for the Invisible Man where they would put the powder and stuff on him so you could see him. It wasn't consistent by any means. That was the only thing that I noticed when I was watching it, where I was like, there are some scenes where scene to scene, he's got like it's spread across his face where it looks like he haphazardly put on. And other times his head's just painted white and that's it. And it's just like, well, it works and it's what it is, but it's a little bit sloppy. That's the only thing I saw in this that I was kind of like, ooh, I did like that character because he's supposed to come across as, yeah, he's a thief because he's become invisible so that he can be a thief. You're not supposed to really like him. And that's okay. It's got that Han Solo sort of like, he's not a good guy, but he's also like not really a bad guy. I liked him, but there isn't a lot. No pun intended. There's not a lot there, though. There's not a lot of character building. He's just like, yeah, no, I'm kind of a bad guy, but I'll do what I need to survive.
Yeah, I think he's a fun, roguish character. He brings a lot of personality, and he really helps the mystery of the film because you know that somebody's tampering with things. And of course, he's the most obvious pick because he could walk around and you won't know that he's there. And there's even like that book falling moment with Captain Nemo. It's like building that little bit of intrigue. And then, you know, it's a fun reveal that it's like, oh, wait, it wasn't him. It was Dorian.
And he vanishes. I mean, not just he's invisible. Yeah. He literally is not in the film for like half of the film. He's just not around. You don't see what happened to him necessarily. You see him get kicked out of a room and then he's just vanished after all these things happen. So you kind of think, well, clearly it's him, right? But again, you do find out eventually that it's Dorian, but that because Dorian also, well, we'll get into that a little bit more, but I think it wasn't as good of a reveal as it could have been. And it's not the fault of the Invisible Man. I think he did a good enough job.
So yeah, let's save that for the way we start talking about the plot a little bit. The character Mina Harker, I had no idea who she was. And by the way, which is strange because she's from Dracula. Mm-hmm. And I love that film, Dracula. And I did not remember her character. I actually had to go back and refigure that out. So whenever I first saw this movie, whenever that was, I remember going through and looking at all the characters saying, what literary characters did I miss? Dorian Gray was one of those. Mina Harker was one of the other ones. Did you guys know who she was during the film?
Yeah, that one I knew. But he even says it like, oh, this is Jonathan Harker's ex-wife or spouse or whatever. Like they made clear, even if you didn't know who Mina was, they were like, Jonathan Harker, you know who that is, right? Wink. And then it was pretty obvious. But I did know that one.
I had watched like the original Dracula. I read Dracula. I knew who her character was. And honestly, this is probably one of the most interesting versions of her in film, because a lot of the time she's like this younger wife and she's put in this situation. And here it's like she's later in her life. She's lived a lot more at this point. And she has that bit of like femme fatale kind of feel. And there are cool effects when like she would turn like full-blown vampire and stuff like that, especially in Venice. I don't know if I've seen Peter Wilson in a whole lot of things after this, but I actually really liked her in this film, and it's kind of a shame that she didn't pop up in more things after this.
So we also have the character Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I do have a question about that character, and maybe you guys can answer me. So when he's Mr. Hyde, he has a giant top hat. Where does that come from?
He keeps it in his pocket. It's he has his pocket, and then when he gets, I don't know. It just looks cool, so you have to have a top hat.
Like the Incredible Hulk, it's like he tears all his shirts off, but his pants somehow are super stretchy and can survive. Like, he literally pulls an extra piece of clothing out and puts it on, and it's a giant top hat. Like, who do you go to, like, what haberdasher do you go to and say, hey, I need a size 200 or whatever size that is in hats? I don't understand, like... It was like of the whole thing of Dr. Commissar, it kept throwing me off. Every time I saw this giant top hat, I'm like, where did he buy this? And also, like, where is it coming from?
You know what? I've watched this movie probably a good dozen plus times and have never once thought about where his massive hat came from. And I think it's just because it, like Jeremy said, it's a fun detail.
Yeah.
Like, it looks cool on him. But, like, yeah, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, to be perfectly honest. But it's interesting because, obviously, this character has been adapted so many times in film. And even, like, Van Helsing that came out the next year also had Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in it. I really liked this, like, Hulk version of Mr. Hyde. And the effects on it are incredible. Like, the practical effects or whatever they're doing to make this character look so detailed. Obviously, they have, like, that super, super hulked out version of the other guy later in the movie. And that's where some of, like, the CGI seams are kind of, like, sticking out in 2003. But, like, he looks fantastic. Jason Fleming, I really like as an actor, whether it's, like, in those early Guy Ritchie movies. And he's popped up in other comic book films. He was Azazel in X-Men First Class.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked him. And he probably had one of the most in-depth performances out of anybody that actually had a lot of range and had a lot of character development. I'm like, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, MVP of this movie, sticking out here in a lot of the ways.
Well, yeah, he's got to be both Dr. Jekyll, which is, it's very much like Hulk. It did remind me of Bruce Banner, where it's like this, I don't really want to be the Hulk. I don't want to be Dr., you know, Mr. Hyde. I know I can, but I'm not going to let him take control of me anymore. You know, and it's like, well, then why are you even here? What's your point? What are you, no one came to talk to you, like, whiny scientist guy. We need to talk to, you know, the Hulk, the Mr. Hyde. So I did like that. I also liked all the scenes where he was Dr. Jekyll and he'd see, like, Hyde in the mirror talking to him and stuff. I thought that was all really cool.
That was pretty cool.
Like, that one moment where he confronts him,
yeah,
like, reaching out, I'm like, that was intense. And I'm like, honestly, out of any of these characters I would want to get a spinoff of, like, I want to see that story and, like, all of his progression through this. And that's why I feel like he's definitely one of the most interesting characters in the movie, for sure.
One of the characters I found most interesting was actually Captain Nemo.
Mm-hmm.
I love that ship. I love all the architecture in the ship. I love the way it looks, the way it feels.
The ship is huge. The ship is massive. But also just the car. He has an automobile. There's not one yet because it's 1899 or whatever. He's got the little...
With six wheels.
Yeah, of course. It kind of looks like the Batmobile. But no one knows that was in 1899, so good for him. Also, the thing that kind of spits out of the ship.
Wait, is Captain Nemo the Batman of this movie?
I mean, kind of. He has all the vehicles. He doesn't have a lot of weird gadgets. He's just really good with a sword and a good fighter other than that. I like the character, but I also think he's pretty two-dimensional. Like, there's not a lot of depth to Nemo. He's just like, oh, yeah, I have all these things, and I can help us get there. And, you know, they kind of hinted, like, well, your past is not great either. He's like, who cares? And he just moves on. Like, he's like, I'm, you know, if they need him to fight, he fights. He's really good at it. But at no point do you think, one, is he the spy or whoever it is you're looking for. You don't think he's the one responsible. And he seems to always have whatever vehicle they're going to need. Or that little, I can't remember what it is. It's like a thing that falls off. It's essentially like a little tiny submarine that comes off the big submarine. And that's a kind of a big plot point as well, that exists. That's how, you know, Dorian Gray escapes at one point. And it's neat, but it's, again, he's there to provide these devices. Otherwise, he's not driving the plot forward, except that he's like, well, I can get us there because I have a bunch of vehicles.
Two things on that. First off, that scene where it falls off, the Nautilette, however they called it. the when the window opens up and you see Dorian Gray in it, that was the worst CGI in the movie.
Yeah, it didn't look
because it was not even lined up properly for where he would be sitting for it. It was like they filmed him in another room in a cockpit of some sci-fi movie, and it's just pasted in. Then that was the worst CGI in the movie.
I would wonder if it wasn't there originally, and after they put it out, someone at the studio was like, "We have to have that. They're not going to always in there." You're like, "No, it's pretty clear he's in there." No, you got to make sure they can see him. Like, there's no window. Yeah, there is. Make that bubble a window. Okay. So yeah, it definitely did not look like it fit in.
And I did like the fact that the Nautilus had effectively almost ICBM missiles. The fact that it targeted the ship and, like, it went up high in the atmosphere and came back down. I mean, they're worried about the Phantom making these weapons of mass destructions. They already have them.
Nemo has them.
Nemo has them all.
I am a huge Jules Verne fan, and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is one of my favorite books growing up. So I was super excited to see Captain Nemo in this. And this is a far cry from, like, James Mason Captain Nemo from that, like, Disney adaptation with Kirk Douglas back in, like, the 50s. And I appreciated, like, the twist of making him Sikh. And this is definitely the character that had the most room to really explore some stuff that they just didn't dedicate enough time to. Like the moment when you see Mina Harker and you have Alan Quatermain seeing him praying to that statue, and you're just like, there is so much more they could have really dug into this. And I don't remember the actor's name well enough to say it off the top of my head, but I think he did really well for somebody who most of his job was to spout exposition and everything, and like his cool fight sequences and stuff like that. I really enjoyed the character a lot. I just wish that there was more to this character, because there is definitely potential to have a lot more.
I mentioned the character M, or the Phantom, to spoiler for everybody. He's the same person. When I first watched the movie, though, I was like, oh, it's M, like from James Bond. And not until the very, very end did I realize it's Moriarty.
Yep.
And going back and rewatching again, there are hints through the whole movie that it's actually Moriarty. At the time, I felt it was very like, oh, how convenient. It's Moriarty, and he's a good villain, I guess. You know, Sherlock Holmes. But they actually do, you know, sort of seed that through the whole movie, that this is actually Moriarty, that M is Moriarty, versus just, I was thinking, like, it was a callback to, like, this is where the MI6 started, essentially. Mm-hmm.
There's that moment where one of his henchmen yells to the Phantom, James.
Yep.
And, like, that's probably one of the most overt, like, hints to, like, who that character might actually be. And Richard Roxburgh, who, you know, was the main antagonist in Moulin Rouge, then he was Dracula and Van Helsing the next year, which was interesting. Obviously, he gets to play it up a lot more when he's under, like, the Phantom makeup. He puts on the accent and everything. And for most of it, he's just, like, really, like, prim and proper British man. But I thought that was, if you're going to get any antagonist out of all of these to be, like, this mastermind of a world war, of course it's going to be Moriarty from Sherlock Holmes. So I think that fit in very well. And, you know, there's definitely a lot of tightening of the script they could have done, but I really love the concept of this movie, and he's a big linchpin to, like, the overall idea of how this really all comes together.
Now, the character I'm most embarrassed by not realizing who it was the American agent.
Tom Sawyer.
Which is really bad about this. You guys are going to hate me for this. I didn't know it was Tom Sawyer until this morning. I have seen this movie so many times, and I was like, oh, it's just an American they're plugging in there from the Secret Service. And which is funny, I was reading some behind the scenes stuff, and they put Tom Sawyer in the movie. He's not in the books.
No.
But they put him in the movies because they thought American audiences would not appreciate these characters without an American character in there. And me, as an American, had no clue he was Tom Sawyer.
No.
He does say his name is Sawyer, but I don't make the connection, because Tom Sawyer was seen as a kid, because there are later books where he's a detective and all this sort of stuff. But I did not read those books, so I did not make that connection. But what's even funnier is that he is a special agent. Oh, I forgot the acronym is. But anyway, he's an American Secret Service. So his acronym is like SOS ass. Is actually what, and he did it on purpose. Because he's supposed to be the ass of the movie, which he isn't really. But I had no idea it was Tom Sawyer until this morning upon my umpteenth viewing of this movie.
See, I didn't mind him. I think at first I was kind of like, because I didn't know he wasn't part of the book originally, right? So I wouldn't have even been like, why did they add this character? But I took it as, if you're going to have somebody who Quatermain's passing the torch to, he's clearly the character he's kind of picked. He has this tie to his son, kind of, like, he makes him think of his son. But also just there's all the things that he's just too old to do. And this younger character can do those things. And it also works on that. Well, he's training him while he does it. But that way, if there's all these action scenes, they can kind of split off where he's just trying to you know, shoot a gun. But Tom Sawyer's doing all this physical stuff in the background. I thought it worked, especially because they're supposed to have, and again, this is part of the script. I don't know if it's part of the original source material. It's like, oh, there's six people. And he becomes like the mysterious seventh. But really, it is six, because Dorian Gray is not really part of the group. So it kept the group at six. I didn't mind it, but I found out after I watched this movie that he was not in the original story. And I'm not overly surprised, I guess, because he also doesn't, I mean, I didn't read the later Tom Sawyer stuff either, but I wouldn't have thought of if I had to pick an American storybook hero, it would not have been Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, I like and appreciate how this character fits into the story with the relationship with Quatermain and all those elements. And yeah, I was not aware that Tom Sawyer becomes like a detective and stuff in later books and stuff like that, but like, this felt like the most ham-fisted in, like, addition of a character. This could have been any
yeah,
body, like sharpshooting American character. And she's like, oh, it's Tom Sawyer. You all know who Tom Sawyer is. And I don't think Shane West is particularly bad, but I feel like him and Stuart Townsend are kind of the ones that stand out here that were like, these were the young people they were really trying to make happen.
Yeah.
At this point in time. And I don't know. I think maybe a stronger performer with like those more emotional moments would have made it stick a little bit better. But at the end of the day, I do appreciate the added depth that that character brings to Quartermain. And the shooting practice scene was one of the few moments where this movie like slowed down for us to get some character moments. And that's why I appreciate that scene, because otherwise this movie's like rushing.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
The whole entire plot. So,
well, the first half of the movie is getting these six characters together, which is fine. Again, especially a movie that's not, most people don't know the source material. It's not like when you go out and you see the Avengers, you're like, oh man, I hope they spend half the movie getting the Avengers together. Like, you don't want that. You know who the Avengers are. Get started, get moving. And thankfully, they have movies for everybody in that damn crew on their own if you want to find out more about their backgrounds and not read any comics ever, right? But this, you kind of have to have the introductory of, like, how are this group going to get together? I mean, thankfully, there is a mission. There is an agency, essentially, trying to pull them together for Britain. So it makes sense that they're finding these people. But yeah, they have to not just get the first four of them together, but then they have to go get Dorian Gray, and there's a whole fight scene there, and then they have to get Mr. Hyde. So it's like they have, by the time you've gotten all six of these characters together and they're on their way to this mission in Italy, then they're like, or in Venice, it's still Italy, but they're on the way to Venice, more than half the movie's gone, right? So then the rest is just like, bam, 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 bam. And even to get them together, it's fast. You're right, there's like a handful of slow moments, the very beginning, and literally the very, very beginning. And then that scene where they're working on shooting out on top of the submarine.
Well, and this movie is, we might as well switch in the scenes a little bit, but this movie effectively is the origin story of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But the one thing I think it's nice about is because these characters, we know these characters from other things, they don't have to spend a lot of time on who these characters are. Like, there's no, I know, Jeremy, you're not a big fan of big origin stories, and this doesn't really have that problem in my mind, because you don't have to spend time with 30 minutes finding out who is Captain Nemo, and right, 15 minutes on, me and Harker, like I said, I didn't know who she was, but I didn't need that, right? She's just there, she's actually a vampire, and we move on.
Well, and Hyde, right? I mean, they go to get Mr. Hyde, but as soon as you see who it is and they say his name, you're like, okay, like there's no need to explain it. And you can see what he is. He's a giant, you know, beast of some sort. So like, yeah, this is a giant man beast, why wouldn't you bring this person in as your muscle on the group? And knowing that he also has the ability to not be a giant beast, even though you didn't know that when you first see him. I like the transformations. I have to say the Mr. Hyde to and from transformations to Dr. Jekyll, I did appreciate. They still hold up okay, because it's mostly practical effects, and it's not just this, you know, extreme CG that you'd see in other films. So I think it still holds up really well.
Yeah, there's only really four introduction scenes. There's the longer one where we first introduce Quartermain, because he is the main character, and he is the actor who cost him $17 million. So he does get a little bit longer of an intro scene. And then there's the introduction to the entire league, which is, you know, where they spent the rest of their budget on the actors. And then eventually we move from there to the Dorian Gray introduction scene. And then we have the Hyde introduction scene. And that's really about it. And Hyde's an action scene, right? That's a chase scene.
Well, so is Dorian Gray, because they go to visit him, and that's where they meet, you know, M finds them. Well, not M, I guess. The Shadow finds them at that point.
The Phantom.
But even then, like, that was, you know, we kind of talked about a little bit about how there's this, they determine that somebody in that crew is not on their team and is working against them secretly. To what level, they don't know. But when you first meet Dorian Gray, they're there, they meet him. They come into the house, and then immediately all of the Shadow's forces show up, which, I mean, it's possible, and it is a movie. You got to put some disbelief aside in general, but even then you're kind of like, there's no way that he didn't tip them off that they were coming. So I always felt like from the get-go, like, he's probably not a good guy. So they made it a little obvious.
Now, that scene's also where they introduce, you know, Tom Sawyer's character.
Yep.
And there's actually a deleted scene that occurred during that time period where Tom Sawyer tells them why he's there. Because he kind of just shows up. Like, I think he's in disguise or something. And
he's in disguise and he winks at Quartermain.
Yeah, and that's it. It's like, that's really sort of why he's there. And the actual deleted scene was, he's explained to everybody that he and his partner have been tracking down the Phantom, and the Phantom killed his partner, Huck Finn.
I don't mind that that's not there. I mean, not that it's any less ham-fisted than being named Tom Sawyer. And I guess if you're going to pick a friend of Tom Sawyer, I'm glad they went with Huck Finn.
But see, so if they had done that, I would have felt less stupid because I'd be like, oh, it's Tom Sawyer.
There's definitely some ham-fisted moments. Like, one of them especially is when Quartermain arrives for the meeting and he's like, not as fast as Phineas Fogg. Got around the world in 80 days. I'm just like, just dropping that lampshade there. Just like, those were some of the moments where I'm just like, Sean Connery is probably rolling his eyes, like thinking like, I have to read this.
Okay, it was a little funny story for you. So I was watching this movie this morning and I was, you know, I'm the only one around, and I turned out my mother-in-law is visiting because my oldest is graduating, and she walks in and hears that piece of dialogue. She goes, that's some terrible dialogue, and then leaves the room.
I wish
that's all she heard of the entire movie.
Anytime I'm watching any of these movies or any video game and no one's home and then someone walks in the room, it's always the most inappropriate section of whatever it is. This has nothing to do with this movie because there's nothing in this movie that pulls off that far, but I don't know if you guys play Final Fantasy 15. It's like an older Final Fantasy, not older at this point, it's two Final Fantasies ago, but still it's like 10 years ago. But there's, the game's fine, but there's a girl that works at the garage that helps fix your car up, and she's always wearing like the skimpiest outfits and like laying on your car, and it's like, okay, whatever, like I don't care about it. Every single time I went to the garage, my wife would walk in the room, she's like, you're embarrassing, and we just walk out every single time. So that's what happens for me for reasons. I wish it was just bad dialogue, but no, it's always like the one scene where you're like, oh, she took her top off for no reason, cool, and then they walk out like, no, the rest of me's not like this.
It's always those kinds of moments. But no, I legitimately think the worst part of this movie is the screenplay. Like, there's just, somebody could have touched up some of the, a lot of the dialogue in this movie. And, you know, it's just, they just wanted to be like, how many literary references could we fit into this movie? So just, you know, slip in some of those. I feel like I watched that deleted scene on my DVD. Because I distinctly remember, like, that moment. I'm just like, I was probably a teenager at that point. I'm just like, wow. And just be like, yeah, I can see why they took this out. Because him being Tom Sawyer to begin with just seems ridiculous in context. And then it's just like, yeah, my buddy, Huck Finn, wink at the camera. And just like, yep, this movie went there.
So this movie, you guys have kind of mentioned, it's go, until we have the emotional scene of him, like, connecting with Tom Sawyer as a potential, like, surrogate for his son, right? Mm-hmm. What were some of your favorite scenes in this movie, or least favorite scenes, whichever?
I love the Hyde capture, like, that whole scene, and then also just him in the chains and the ship where he's, you know, then he eventually is like, watch this, and then kind of becomes, the first time you see him, transform back into a regular person. I like that, because it made him look threatening. It still looks really good. I love the Hulk anyway, so the fact there's a Hulk-like character in here, big mm-hmm. fan. So I like that. I thought most of the action scenes were actually pretty good. Yep. I have to say, like, most of the Nemo scenes where he's just running around with a sword and stuff, they were solid action scenes right there. He's not doing anything, like, extremely flashy. He just moves really well, and he's just taking guys down effectively with a sword and, you know, kind of dancing around a little bit while he does it. It looks good. Generally, I was pretty impressed with most of the scenes in the movie. There wasn't anything scene-wise where I was like, oh, I wish this wasn't in here. Like, I think it moved fast enough because it had a lot of ground to cover. So there was nothing that I was like, man, I hated this scene. There were definitely, again, some dialogue choices that weren't great. But I thought, generally, it moved pretty well. And I enjoyed even the... actually, the only scene, and again, maybe this is the source material, but the very end, the whole African... They explained it earlier that there's like, he went to talk to a priest, a voodoo priest or whatever, and an African priest. But then they bring it at the end and it doesn't feel like it fits in and it's really out of place. And it looks like that looks weird. And I don't know if it's supposed to be a dream sequence. I don't really know. I thought it didn't fit, but that's like, that's probably just me misunderstanding the source material.
The point of that was, he says in the beginning that now he's basically, Africa won't let him die as long as Africa needs him. But then Dorian Gray says, like, I forget who it says, but it's like, you're not in Africa right now.
Yeah, but you're not in Africa anymore. Yeah.
And so they bring his body back to Africa, which brings him back to life.
It's implied. You don't see him come back to life. It's implied that he does. But even then, it was just like, I don't know. It felt out of place. I didn't think they necessarily needed to do it. It's fine, but it was definitely, that's the only scene where I was like, eh. But it was the end of the movie, so I didn't care. You get to see the conclusion, and then this last part happened. You have to have something. I got what they were aiming at. I thought it was a good handing off to the next. He even says, like, his last lines are like, this next century is yours, this last century is mine, or something like that. I can't remember the exact word to Tom Tom Sawyer.
Well, they got to bring him back. He was contracted for 3 movies.
Knowing that they were going to think about doing more and then that was the ending, that's more disappointing because that's a horrible ending if you know he's going to be back.
Yeah, we'll get into sort of what their plans were. But yeah, this was supposed to be the beginning of a trilogy.
Well, and the source material, there's at least 2 more follow-ups, if not 3. So there was source material. Again, I don't know how close this was. Apparently not much. But they had other things they could pull from to continue this story.
I always thought this concept had so much room to grow with. Like, this is, like, perfect for a franchise. Mm-hmm. Like, bringing in other literary characters and meeting them along the way and stuff like that. And, of course, it has the obnoxious teaser for a sequel. Where it's like, they're gonna bring him back. It's like the same exact shot at the end of Batman v Superman. Of his grave, and just like, well, Sean Connery's coming back. Just kidding, he retired, and he's like, I'm done with this.
Never doing, not any other character, not just this one.
Yeah, not done doing this again. I guess it didn't make enough money for them to, like, pull the trigger on making a sequel either. But I do love the high chase sequence where they hunt him. That's a really awesome staged action sequence. I do really like the car chase through Venice because it allows them to show everybody
mm-hmm.
doing their thing. And that's like one of the first, like, wow, they're a team. And they're bringing this all together and showing off their powers and stuff like that. I actually like the very beginning of the film, I think it's very intriguing, that setup with the Phantom, with the tank and all that stuff. And I thought that was a nice little way to start the film. And I really like the introduction of Alan Quartermain, you know, sans, like, editing around, you know, Sean Connery's limitations physically. But I thought that was a really well-staged scene. The little mystery of, like, he has his buddy.
Yeah, I love that.
It's, like, his one that, who also, he's a pretty famous British actor. I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but, like, he was in Gladiator and stuff like that. And the eyebrows. And, like, that sequence I really like in the film. And rewatching this, because I mentioned this at the very beginning, I loved this movie when I was a kid. And then late teens, early 20s, I'm like, oh, this, I don't know why I like this. And then watching this now in my soon-to-be mid-30s, I'm just like, honestly, a lot more of this movie from a filmmaking standpoint holds up a lot better than I thought it was going to. And one of my biggest takeaways was, like, it was obviously they used CGI in places, but it was actually really refreshing that a lot of this movie was very practical and actually looked really good.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, they don't make movies like this anymore, and it makes me sad.
The CGI usage, we'll get the CGI too, like, is very minimal, but the places where they did use it, you noticed it. Like I said, mm-hmm. in the eye of that ship, the fire of that hotel burning down where Charlemagne is beginning, like, it looked like something I'd make, you know, for fun on my video editor here on the laptop. But you're right, it felt like there were a lot of practical effects. I don't know for certain, but it felt like there were a lot. And even, like, on Hyde shrinking back to, you know, Dr. Jekyll, like, they do a lot of quick cuts to make that work, so you don't see how clunky his costume probably really is and all the different stages that body horror look as it's transforming back.
It was definitely, but it was definitely doing different shots of him with different makeups on, right? It's not just, oh, we're going to, you know, CG out this big character, then slowly morph it back into a person. Like, it was different. I mean, you know, we watched, what, The Guyver and some other ones that have very clear, like, practical effects like that. It reminded me, it wasn't that extreme, but it reminded me of something like that, where it had some really good, for his specific effects. Also, as far as neat practical effects, just the Shadow, you know, / Moriarty, when he, you know, gives away who he is, and he just pulls his other makeup off. Or then it's clear, it's like, oh, he not only is it practical, but he's very clear about, like, no, I put this on. And it looks neat. Like, I like how he just rips off the makeup, and it still leaves a little bit on his face, and it's not quite right, because it was makeup. It was just a disguise. So that was actually pretty cool, and I thought it looked good. Like, I liked how the Shadow looked before you knew who it was. I didn't think it gave away who it was. I know there were clues, but it wasn't obvious looking at him that was who it was going to be, which I liked.
Yeah, I like the fact that when he does reveal himself, and he even, like, peels off the other makeup, and he's like, it's M, and he goes, you don't even know the whole thing or whatever. Yeah. Like, he's alluding that there might be even more behind this. And you're like, who's M's boss? Of course, there is no boss for M.
Right, that's, you figure it's like, oh, who's he working for? And then you're like, oh, no, I see.
That's actually really interesting double reveal of, like, the Phantom is M, but then M is this, and it's just like, because he has a very obvious different English accent. when he says that, I'm like, wait a minute. And just like, he was putting on a fake posh British accent earlier. And, you know, that's something like, going back and watching some movies from this era, Richard Roxburgh was actually like a really talented, fun actor that popped up in a few things. And it's so crazy how many parallels are between this and the Van Helsing film. Just to reinforce, the Mr. Hyde in that one is full CGI, like a year later, and it's so visible that he looks like a video game character in a movie. And that's what I think really reinforces why the practical effects they did in this movie is so good. And one other scene that I really loved was like the redemption of Hyde, where like he has to save all those sailors when the ship's flooding. Like, I love that moment where like he's like pulling the that lever and stuff like that, because it was a really great character moment, and that really stood out to me too.
Well, and that's when he is willing to take on Hyde again, right? He wasn't going to do it. He's refusing to go on this mission in Venice because he's not going to do it. And all of a sudden, he's like, well, to save everybody, I've got to do this. I'm the only one who can do it. And I said I wouldn't do this, but this is the only reason to do it. And I like that. It was also him kind of re-accepting that part of him, right? So I like that.
So this movie is 110 minutes long. Did it feel like that?
No. No, this one flew by. Like we talked about, it moves and moves and moves. And we mentioned that there's a slower moment, but it really is a slower moment. It's not, oh, there's a 20-minute scene where they talk about his son, and then he tries to practice firing a rifle for 100 times. Like, it is like 2 minutes of a slowdown, and then it's right back to it. It just nonstop moves. This is another example of one that I think if this was redone now, it would be a series, and you'd have time to really kind of breathe out some of these details. You wouldn't want to watch a six-hour movie of this, but you would totally watch 6 one-hour episodes of this. And I think there's a lot going on in this. So it doesn't feel like an hour and 10 minutes. It feels a little rushed, but I think there's no way to avoid that if you still want to have even the amount of little bit of depth they got with some of these characters.
This movie would 100%, if this was redone as a movie, this 100% would be 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Like, this definitely would give this a lot more time to flesh out all these characters. But no, in today's era of where film and television's kind of blurring that line, this definitely would be a series. Like, I could see HBO doing something like this and putting this out as like a big prestige comic book kind of series. That or Amazon. I feel like one of them would put the money into bring this. And honestly,
you hope it's HBO
this
to do a better job.
I would definitely hope that was HBO. This is one of those films that like I want to see this get remade. Because this is such a great concept, and this film's clunky.
Yeah.
And I still really enjoy it and have a lot of fun with it, but there's a lot of obvious flaws. This has so much potential, and I would not be mad if they took the time and tried to redo this at some point. So maybe they will. We'll see.
As someone who's read the source material recently, do you think that they should stay closer to that, or do you like kind of the liberty they took with this as in general? Does it not seem like it would become a good film the way it's written?
No, if you adapted this more clearly to the actual first run of the graphic novel, it would have to be a show. Like, there's no way that they would be able to adapt that well into a singular movie. And I think that was probably one of the reasons why they changed the story a lot. Like, I think this story fits a movie format.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it needed some more time to breathe with some of its characters and stuff like that.
From what I was reading, like just like how Wanted, they started making the movie while the comic was still coming out in the initial run. That's what happened here as well. So they got the concept of the movie, the concept of where it was going to go, and then adapted it to a movie while this was being written, if I remember correctly.
Interesting. That is very interesting.
So we've kind of touched on the CGI and the practical effects, but do those hold up? I mean, it's been 20 years.
I think there's a lot of it that does hold up, especially in comparison to a lot of big budget of comic book movies today that are just all CGI. And obviously when it gets really CGI, I think there's some moments with the Nautilus that don't look the best. I know we said with the little pod that didn't look great at all. And I think one of the most glaring things is when you do get that like super Hyde, that looked really bad in a lot of ways. Because, like, that was very obviously CGI, because there's no way in hell they could make a character that big practical. But, honestly, I felt a little refreshing. Like, I own this on DVD. I want to get a 4K of this and see what this looks like, because recently I watched the Van Helsing 4K, and some of that CGI Hugh Jackman werewolf in that looks incredible. And I'm like, some of this stuff really holds up, honestly. And I think it's because they were still relying a decent amount on practical effects when they could.
No, Fergal's not with us today. And I think there is there's a little trivia fact I want to share that Fergal, I think, would really appreciate. And so it'll sort of make him feel bad for not being here today. During the promotional period, when they're trying to like sell this movie out, there are a lot of posters that were made. They made posters of each individual character to sort of highlight that they're in there. And Peter Wilson, her character, for her, they actually enhanced her breasts for the promotional videos to sell more tickets. Did it work?
It worked well enough that I remember those posters being a 12-year-old. That's wild. And that's the thing. I distinctly remember those posters. And yes, of course, this is an early aughts movie. They leaned heavily into cleavage. And it's just like, it was so shameless because there's never a moment in this movie because she's like dressed very Victorian style. Like she even has like all the way up to her neck because, you know, she's trying to hide the fact that she has a bite on her neck. And it's just like, no, that's not the vibe this movie was going for. But you know, you got to get teenage boys in seats in the theater,
That is hilarious. I did not remember that. I saw that on the fact list. I'm like, that can't be true. I mean, I used to like, it could be true, but you know, did it really work? And here it is. Shane, you're tempted by these promotional posters. So for our audience out there, go out and Google. Go find these things. I haven't looked for it yet. I probably should, but I'm curious, like, how much actual enhancement they did for this movie.
Because it was one of those things where it's like, her poster was very sexualized in a way that, like, this movie doesn't sexualize, like, anybody. Like, this doesn't have time to do a whole lot of stuff like that. But, you know, you gotta sell the movie, right?
Sexy vampires were a thing back then, so.
They were, and that is part of her character, is kind of that seductive, you're not quite sure until you find out. I mean, you kind of can assume if you know the character, but you don't know that she's a vampire at first. You're just kind of like, oh, is she like this seductive, you know, kind of super spy sort of character? And you're like, oh no, not quite. That's not quite what she's got going on. So that is part of the character. I don't remember those posters. I was going to make a joke that they did the same thing for Sean Connery, but I don't remember the posters. So.
Get a lot of enhancements done before coming to this movie. So Sean Connery, we kind of talked about a little bit, like this was his last movie because he had such a bad experience, as he called the new way to make films. He didn't like it that much. And the director, Stephen Norrington, the two of them butted heads quite a bit. In fact, so much so, Steve Norrington said he will never direct a movie again. And this was his last movie. So the two of them ended each other's careers, essentially. And there was a scene where, I'm trying to see if I get this right, where, you know, the scene where they're in Venice and they're doing like, they're coming off the ship. They're kind of lined up. It's sort of like the hero walk version for this movie. And Sean Connery yelled at the director saying, like, was that good enough for you? Because he was just angry all the time. And the director was like, for $18 million, you're doing it again. Like, that was the kind of relationship that they had on set. But yeah, the two of them, after this movie was done, did films again, which I think is just crazy. But why don't we jump into sort of some things that they thought about putting in this movie, or they were going to and they changed their mind, besides that Huck Finn deleted scene. So one of these was that there was a character they were going to put in this movie. They had it figured out. They even had it casted and changed their mind. And that was, they were going to have the character Sir Champion Bond, who was the intelligence officer for the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and played by Roger Moore.
I mean, that's neat, but I don't need that. Like, I get why they thought that would be cool, but I don't mind that that's not there.
12-year-old Bond super fan Shane would have loved that. But like, objectively, as an adult, thinking about like that, just it would have just been too much, I feel like, to just throw in there.
You'd have two Bonds in the same movie.
Could have done it.
So the character Mina Harker, they did have a person before they were looking at using Monica Bellucci. Familiar with that is?
Yep. Yeah, she was in The Matrix.
She was. She's like a really famous Italian actor, and
she dropped out last minute because of a scheduling conflict, not because she didn't want the role.
Dang. That's really interesting.
Would 12-year-old Shane appreciated that?
Yes. Because, like, especially because this was right off the heels of, or around the same exact time Matrix Reloaded came out. Was that the scheduling conflict? Because
I don't know, but she played Persephone in the Matrix. I know that.
Yep. That's very interesting, because if I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to think, was she a bride in Bram Stoker's Dracula from Francis Ford Coppola?
Oh, I don't know.
Trying to remember that, but, you know, she, quote-unquote, became a Bond girl at 50. Weird calling her a Bond girl at that point, but that would have been very interesting because she was a much more established star at that point, especially internationally. That would have been interesting that they had another big name like that. I really liked Wilson's performance, so like I'm not upset that it was recast at that point.
Now, for the role of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, they did have someone else in mind. David Thewlis, you familiar with him?
Oh, David Thewlis.
Yes, Thewlis. He was in Harry Potter. He was in Wonder Woman, I believe. Yep.
Yeah, he was Ares, as it turned out, Wonder Woman. He's a fantastic actor, and that would have been a really interesting choice, too. Yet again, it's so funny that some of my favorite smaller supporting performances in this were going to be potentially other people, because I thought Jason Fleming did a really good job. So, like, I'm not upset, but that would have been a really good bit of casting, too.
Now, Jeremy, you might appreciate this one. For The Invisible Man, there was another person they had lined up for the role, but just could not land at the very end. Eddie Izzard.
Really? I mean, I guess he could have done it. I've seen him do roles that aren't Eddie Izzard, right? So he could have done it, I guess. But also, he's invisible, so they could have picked anybody for most of the part.
He definitely would have had that, like, roguish sass to the character, too. That would have been very interesting. Very interesting casting there, so.
Now, this, as I mentioned before, this was a planned trilogy. They didn't have the third script figured out, but they were actually working on the second script. And the way it was going to work, and there's actually hints of it in the movie. And what that was, it was going to be a War of the Worlds style movie. Because there's a poster in the background, like some newsprint that says like a volcanic eruption has occurred on Mars. So there was going to be a Martian invasion was the second movie. Do you want to see that movie?
That's wild. That's like a wild leap from like a world war conspiracy to a Martian invasion. I guess War of the Worlds would have been in public domain at that point. Maybe they could have used the Invisible Man at that point, both H.G. Wells. But like, yeah, I would have wanted to see it happen just because like, that's wild. That's such a bold leap for a second movie in a trilogy to just go like, you know, World War wasn't enough. We need to leap to alien invasions. I don't know why aliens would be so much harder for me to process in this world than, like, you know, vampires and all the other things, but, like, that's wild to me that they wanted to have a War of the Worlds adaptation in this.
And the only reason they didn't greenlight it was the movie made its money back, and it just got such a bad, like, no, at the time, people were like, this was amazing. It was so much competition that summer, so it wasn't standing out. And, of course, Sean Connery saying, I'm never coming back. That just killed the franchise.
Well, it's not just that. Alan Moore, you know, disowned it. There was a lot of after the fact. It wasn't as like before. And he was like, no, I don't support this. But after it came out, I was like, this wasn't what I would have. This isn't my book. Right. So that you have a lot of kind of people involved with this disowning it or saying it's a bad experience, saying they don't want to do this anymore. I'm not surprised they didn't continue this because it didn't make enough money to say that it was a blockbuster. And it didn't even win any awards. It apparently was put up for some awards, and they lost it to Lord of the Rings. So, there you go.
But we could have had alien invasions.
Yeah, I don't think that would have... I mean, again, maybe they could have made it interesting. I don't see how that ties in with these characters very well. But what do I know?
So, but when it comes to this movie in particular, what do you guys love about it, and what could they have done better that would have put it over the top?
I think for me, to really put it over the top, another run or two on the script. Like, I feel like that's the biggest thing that takeaway for me is that this is a pretty clunky put together film with clunky dialogue and stuff like that. It has such a great idea, and there's some of the performances that are really good, and some of the casting was great. I think a couple of runs on the script and maybe one or two recastings, I think this could have been a really great film. I still have a lot of fun with it, so... You know, I've been watching this for 23 years on and off, so, like, obviously I still enjoy the experience and, you know, enough for me to want to come on a podcast and talk about it.
I would say I have to agree that the script is really the weakest part of this. I think the effects hold up pretty well. I don't disagree that some of the castings could be redone, but I don't think any of them are disastrous castings, right? There's nothing here that was just awful. If anything, I know that you needed Sean Connery to be the name in this, but they could have tried with somebody else that might have not been as as annoyed with the process of making this movie. But I think this actually, I would say, I understand why they have Tom Sawyer in here, and I'm trying to think if there's another character. I would say you maybe want less characters in it, because it is a lot to cover in the time frame you have. I think if they would have had maybe one or two less characters to focus on, you could have kind of developed those other characters a little bit more. But that's a minor complaint. I really do think it's just that the script is a little too obvious in some spots and a little too self-referential than it needs to be.
Shane, you've been saying it over and over again. The concept is really neat, and that sort of revisionist history is a lot of fun. And to take characters we've all known and grown up with and shove them into, like, it's almost like a fanfic in a sense.
Yes.
It's a lot of fun. And the issue is that script was super weak, like all fanfics. We sort of touched on it earlier, guys. For this movie, should they reboot it? And if so, should it be a TV show? Should it be a movie? Because there is talk right now of them rebooting this movie franchise.
I would love for them to reboot it. I think they should probably give it a go as a series to really flesh things out. And if they could get Ralph Fiennes to play Alan Quartermain, I am sold. Like, because he loves doing genre films like this, and I feel like he would be like a perfect choice to have this vibe, especially like after he was in the King's Man, that most recent Kingsman movie. I really think that like there's so much potential for so many different literary characters you could play around with, and really getting the right cast for this. Come on, HBO, do this. We want it. Or at least I want it. I'll watch it.
With a lot of these things, I end up saying I wish it was a series now, because that is kind of a better format for taking these things that were set up as issue by issue by issue and really, you know, kind of filling that out. I know you don't have to follow the same story or not, but I would prefer to see this as a series, giving you a lot more chance to have, like, not, you don't even need a ton of backstory in each character, but just a lot more connecting tissue than this movie's going to give you with a 2-hour time frame. So I would say redo it as a series. I think it could be tried as a movie. I just think we kind of run into the same issue with that's a lot to cover in 2 hours.
Yeah, ensemble cast with no backgrounds. It's really hard to shove that all together. HBO could probably pull off, but I mean, Apple's been doing a lot of great things with TV shows a lot lately too. And Apple might give it the runway it might need. Unlike don't do a Netflix. Netflix will cancel it halfway through the series. For this movie, though, this version of it, Sean Connery's magnum opus, his final film, should people go out and find it?
I think if you're a fan of Sean Connery, I think he tries his best in this with obviously something that he does not understand. See, now I actually wanted to see him fight aliens and for him to really be like, what is this? But I think his performance here feels like a nice swan song for his career. I just wish it was like a stronger movie around it. And I am not surprised this did it to him, to be honest. And, you know, I've been a huge Sean Connery fan since I was a kid, watching James Bond and stuff like that. And I was very upset when I found out that he retired after making this movie, especially because as a 12-year-old, I absolutely love this. I think people should go back and check this out, especially if you're frustrated with a lot of, like, the extremely heavy CGI kind of blockbusters we're getting. This does a really good job of making it more grounded, and you can feel it with a lot of practical effects. And I always go back to, like, 1999's The Mummy. They just don't make action-adventure movies like that anymore that feel like you are getting lost on this adventure. And this has those kinds of vibes, and it's from that kind of era. So I think it's worth people going back and checking this out.
Yeah, this is definitely a fun movie. Again, I've not read the source material. I want to now. I'd like to actually, because I'm sure you can get all of it together in one easy-to-find package to read everything that's been put out. I like this concept a lot. I can see how this would be a really neat comic, and there's, you know, there's plenty of comics I read now where they're series, you know, short-run series that it's a neat concept, but I'm not sure how well it would transfer to another medium. And I think this might be one of those situations where I'll read the original and be like, oh, I see why they didn't film it this way. But I do like what they did with the idea. But as a standalone, fun movie to watch, like, I actually enjoyed this. I didn't, you know, have to take a break. I didn't roll my eyes too hard at it. I had a good time watching this. So, yeah, go out and find this. It's an interesting take on these characters, if nothing else.
Shane, I liked how you said this. Like, it reminded you of the 1999 Mummy movie. Because when you said that, it sort of sparked at my sort of light bulb in my head that this is an action adventure, and we don't get action adventures anymore. And Sean Connery is, you know, one of the original action adventure, you know, stars. It's a fun sort of easy watch. It will not make you cry. It will not bring any high level emotion to you. There's no weight to this movie. But at the same time, it's not as bad as I remember it being. Like, I remember being like, oh my God, it's that movie again kind of thing. So when I watched it again, I was like, oh, okay, this, I'm not like saying this is amazing. This is the best piece of cinema I've seen in the past decade. But I say this so often, we have seen far worse things on this podcast. Far worse things. And I enjoyed watching it. There were some bad jokes I chuckled at. And it's a, your family can watch it with you. You've got small kids. They can watch this movie. And there's no real gore to it. You know, it's, but they get to see these characters that they're going to have to read in, you know, 11th grade English classes. And it's a fun watch. So go out and find it. If you haven't seen it, I got it for like $5 in the discount bin. It's worth the $5 I spent. So in closing, guys, before we head out of here, how would you actually rate this movie?
I would give this a 3/4 thumb up, but it's covered in powder so you can see it because it's an invisible 3/4 thumb up.
I would give this, invite a bunch of your friends over, have some beers, have a good time. This is a fun time. You're not going to remember this for very long, but it was a fun time.
Yeah, we've learned from Jeremy. You may think you've seen this movie. You may not have. I give this 3/4 of a thumb up too. It's an okay watch. Like, so Shane, you put it right. Have some beers, relax with this thing, and it's, you know, you can play a board game at the same time. It's just fun. Thanks for joining us this evening. But in closing, guys, Shane, where can people find you?
So I have my 5 movie podcasts at the SPM Crew Podcasting Network. That's where I connected with Chris and check them out. All movies, all the time. I am primarily a YouTuber. You can check out the Wasteland Reviewer on YouTube. Been doing that for 9 years. I have a website as well, thewastelandreviewer.blog. And if you're ever wondering where I just collect and shamelessly plug all of it, check out my Instagram, thewastelandreviewer. I love branding.
And Jeremy, where can people find you?
Well, I'm here every 2 weeks with you talking about old movies, but then you can also find me talking about old video games at the Retrovaniacs podcast. Everything Retrovaniacs is found at retrovania.net, and later this summer, I'm not quite sure when this is coming out, but in October, I will be at the Long Island Retro Con, helping out a friend who's running the One Rad Tea / One Rad podcast table, helping out there and promoting Retrovania. So that's where you can find me.
That sounds like a lot of fun. For me, you can always find me at Off Panel Creations. We're always over there building some piece of nerdy furniture. Want to thank you, our listeners, for spending some time with us today. And if you know what character from your 10th grade English class they should add to the reboot, send us a note over at movie-smash.com, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. This has been Movie Smash with Chris Roberts, Jeremy Parmentier, and Fergal Amayo. Produced by me, Chris Roberts. Executive produced by Off Panel Creations, LLC. Movie clips provided by the respective studios. You can rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You might even find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for us? Visit us at movie-smash.com and send us a note. It too can be read on a future episode. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Movie Smash wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Every single time with the garage, my wife would walk in the room. She's like, you're embarrassing. We'd just walk out every single time.